the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lebanese media say the first batch of Iranian fuel oil to help Lebanon arrives in the country through Syria. Lawyers for two Palestinians who were recaptured after escaping from an Israeli prison last week say their clients were badly beaten during their arrest. Also coming up, the UN says at least 1 million Nigerian kids could miss school this year amid a rise in mass school kidnappings and insecurity. From our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, the first batch of the Iranian fuel shipment has arrived in Lebanon after the vessel unloaded at a Syrian port. The vessel carrying the fuel reached Ben Yas port on Sunday. The fuel was then sent by tankers from there. Let's go to Al Ain in the northern Baqar in Lebanon, where Maryam Saleh is standing by, our correspondent. Maryam, so we know Lebanon is going through multiple crises, but perhaps the energy crisis is one of the biggest challenges. With this diesel flowing in now into Lebanon, how much is Hezbollah easing the situation in Lebanon?
Secretary General throughout the days of Ashura. He made it official on the day of Ashura, on the 10th of Muharram. He said that the first ship will be leaving the Islamic Republic of Iran after hours. And now, today, we see this first shipment actually entering Lebanese land, thereby not only breaking the U.S. sanctions against all the U.S. attempts to break Lebanon, but also they have already broken Iran, of course, the unilateral U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran. But not only that, they have also broken the sanctions, so the seizure of sanctions against Syria itself by bringing in that fuel. that will be responsible for the distribution of the fuel. Now, Hezbollah Secretary General had mentioned in his last speech very clearly how this will be organized, how the petroleum will be distributed. He clearly said that there will be a huge portion which will be donated to institutions specifically. We're talking about public hospitals, we're talking about elderly homes, other institutions, orphanages, and in addition to the municipalities that need electricity, that need that diesel in order to retrieve the water from territorial waters. And finally, he said that there's also the Lebanese Red Cross, which will be given the donation as fuel as donations free of charge. He also said that there will be other institutions that will be sold, of course, this diesel, which they really need, but he said the prices will be very low prices. They will be less than the cost price itself, because he stressed that Hezbollah is not seeking any sort of profit or any sort of gains, not even political gains. Now, we do see here that the media is ready to welcome these fuel tankers to film. However, Hezbollah was insistent on the people not to gather in huge crowds for certain security measures, certain fears that there could probably be some security incident of sorts. So therefore, they asked people not to arrive. However, you can probably see the banners. You can see the Hezbollah flags. We saw, of course, we see huge posters of leaders, Hezbollah Secretary General, President of Syria, and the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, because the people have said that they want to thank these countries specifically for assisting Lebanon and bringing in this fuel. Hezbollah Secretary General has also, in his last speech, thanked the Islamic Republic of Iran primarily, and all the authorities and all the officials in the Iranian government for assisting Lebanon and giving Lebanon this fuel, which will be sold in Lebanese lira. And this proves that there will not be any sort of gain, because, as you know, the price of the lira has very much skyrocketed in the face of the dollar. And this has been a part or one of the crises that the Lebanese have been going through. You saw the banners behind me, one of the main ones, too, that are written in English, saying, "You have broken the sanctions, we have broken the siege, and this is another victory, like all the victories in the past, especially after the second liberation of this area. Specifically, this is where we're standing right here, is Al Ain village. You have the other villages that are surrounding it, Labwa and the Nabi Othman village, had always been under attack from the Shakiri terrorists in this area specifically, and after Hezbollah's intervention in Syria and their fight against the Takfiri terrorists on the outskirts of Syria, and the also in the series of mountains that these that are very much close to these villages. They fought the Takfiris for years until we had and saw the second liberation, as Hezbollah has coined it. Now, of course, here we are still waiting for the tankers to arrive. We know that they have already passed through several of the Lebanese villages. They are moving quite in a slow pace because of the heavy loads that they are carrying, and they will not be stopping at any certain point except to go and empty in the main stations where they will be kept for distribution. Hezbollah has already distributed phone numbers for the people to be able to contact in order, or the not only individuals, but also, of course, the institutions to contact in order to retrieve their either the donation or the portion that they can buy, of course, from those stations.
Mariam, thank you very much indeed. Mariam Saleh there, our correspondent, another landmark historic day for Lebanon and for Hezbollah. And Mariam also touched on an important aspect there. Lebanon, the Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance, is popular for its liberation of the country of Lebanese from Israeli occupation, Lebanese territory, and that has perhaps overshadowed its welfare aspects of Hezbollah and its other social programs. Now, Iran has slammed as regrettable what it calls the International Atomic Energy Agency's deliberate silence on Israel's nuclear activities. Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharib Abadi, was responding to a comment by an Israeli envoy. The Israeli official had said the IAEA has been in the dark about Iran's nuclear program for 7 months. Gharib Abadi described the remark as absurd, as it came from a regime that isn't a member of any disarmament treaty. The Iranian diplomat noted that while Tehran is implementing the safeguards, the IAEA has had no information about Israel's nuclear program for well over 5 decades. The lawyers for 2 of the 6 Palestinian inmates who were recaptured after escaping from an Israeli prison say their clients were badly beaten during their arrest. One of the inmates is said to be suffering from a broken jaw and 2 broken ribs. The other also was beaten before being taken to a nearby police station where he was stripped naked and subjected to hours of interrogation. His lawyer says his client has a visible head wound and has been continuously interrogated with little sleep. The lawyers were able to meet with the recaptured prisoners for the first time late Tuesday and early Wednesday. 6 Palestinian prisoners tunneled out of a maximum security prison in Israel on September the 6th. 4 were rearrested a few days later, but 2 of them are still at large. The UN refugee chief says Afghanistan needs urgent and sustained support from the international community to prevent a larger humanitarian crisis. Filippo Grandi said there will be implications if the situation in the country does not improve. In a statement following a 3-day visit to Afghanistan, Grandi said if public services and the economy collapse, there will be even greater suffering, instability, and displacement both within and outside the country. He reiterated that more than 18 million Afghans, or about half the population, required humanitarian aid even before the Taliban takeover last month. Earlier this week, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told an Afghan donors conference that poverty and hunger had spiraled in the country. Let's cross over to the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin Alami is our correspondent there. Amin, welcome. Yeah, I think one of the most important aspects of this whole humanitarian situation is that after 20 years of American occupation, Amin, we're hearing that instead of, you know, the prosperity that Afghans had perhaps expected, poverty rates have increased.
Well, poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan because the people of Afghanistan are now living in a chaotic situation despite the Taliban takeover of the country. The Taliban also say that we are struggling to create jobs and remove concerns of people, especially when it comes to financial issues, by attracting more foreign support. So far, some regional and international regional countries and some international humanitarian bodies have pledged and as well as have sent international humanitarian aids to Afghanistan via Kabul International Airport. For instance, I can point out to the recent flights of Qatari aircrafts as well as UN aircrafts that were landed here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, and they were carrying humanitarian assistance or humanitarian aids to the people of Afghanistan. Deborah Lyons, who is the special UN representative, also met with some top Afghan politicians here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. During his meeting with Sirajuddin Haqqani, the acting interior minister of the Taliban government, he emphasized the importance of continuation of operations of UN-related bodies and other humanitarian agencies in order to resolve the problems and challenges, mainly financial challenges, in Afghanistan and help the people of Afghanistan who are currently living in a very critical situation to receive international humanitarian aids. In the meantime, Pakistani officials also say that we are committed to continue to support Afghan people, especially in terms of supporting them by sending humanitarian aid. So far, at least 1 Pakistani aircraft has landed in Khost International Airport in southeast of Afghanistan. That aircraft was carrying humanitarian aids to the people in this area in eastern Afghanistan. However, the United States of America and some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, including China, Russia, Tajikistan, Iran, Uzbekistan, have also pledged to continue their supports with the people of Afghanistan, but they are insisting on importance of formation of an inclusive government by the Taliban, because they believe that an absence of an inclusive government in Afghanistan, sending international aid to this country would be a very difficult and even an impossible job, because there must be a legitimate government in Afghanistan that take responsibility of distributing these international assistance or international aids. However, the United Nations also say that the Taliban needs to approve operations of non-governmental NGOs inside Afghanistan, not only in humanitarian sectors, but also in other fields, mainly when it comes to women's rights and human rights. I personally saw a long convoy of vehicles of United Nations related bodies in Kabul International Airport, and they came to Kabul just yesterday, and they are going to have some separate meetings with top governmental officials in the Afghan capital Kabul and with some other non-governmental political figures here.
Okay, Amin, thank you very much indeed for that detailed analysis. Amin Alami, our correspondent, joining us from the Afghan capital Kabul. Moving on, the UN Children's Agency says at least 1 million Nigerian kids could miss school this year amid the rise in mass school kidnappings and insecurity. UNICEF said so far this year there have been 20 attacks on schools in Nigeria, with more than 1,400 children abducted and 16 dead. It's added that over 200 kids are still missing. The UN agency reported that more than 37 million Nigerian children are due to start the new school year this month. Schools have become targets for mass abductions for ransom in northern Nigeria by armed groups. Australia confirms it has scrapped a submarine deal with France and launched a new security partnership with the US and Britain to acquire nuclear-powered submarines. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the decision is not a matter of change of mind, but rather a change of need. He said the move was disappointing for France, but it was made considering Australia's national security interests. The trilateral partnership between the US, Australia and the UK was now announced by their leaders in a virtual meeting on Wednesday. Addressing the meeting, Morrison said Australia is not seeking to acquire nuclear weapons.
AUKUS is born, a new enhanced trilateral security partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States. AUKUS, a partnership where our technology, our scientists, our industry, our defence forces are all working together. But let me be clear, Australia is not seeking to acquire nuclear weapons or establish a civil nuclear capability.
Under the new pact, the US and Britain will provide Australia with the technology and capability to deploy nuclear-powered submarines, which Morrison said would be built domestically. Senior American officials have been cited as saying that the Indo-Pacific partnership comes as Washington and its allies are looking for ways to push back against China's growing power and influence. France has, however, slammed as regrettable Canberra's move in scrapping a $90 billion submarine deal with Paris. China also reacted to the alliance, saying countries should shake off their Cold War mentality and ideological prejudice. And New Zealand said it will not lift a decades-long ban on nuclear-powered vessels entering its waters. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
In the limelight. Hospitals in the southern United States are running dangerously low on space in intensive care units, as the Delta variant of the coronavirus has led to spikes in coronavirus cases not seen since last year's deadly winter wave. One in four hospitals now reports more than 95% of ICU beds occupied, up from one in five last month. Experts say it can become difficult to maintain standards of care for the sickest patients in hospitals, where all or nearly all ICU beds are occupied. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Charlie Smart. The piece is titled, COVID Hospitalizations Hit Crisis Levels in Southern ICUs. hospitals in the southern United States are running dangerously low on space in intensive care units, as the Delta variant has led to spikes in coronavirus cases not seen since last year's deadly winter wave. One in four hospitals now reports more than 95% of intensive care unit beds occupied, up from one in five last month. Experts say it can become difficult to maintain standards of care for the sickest patients in hospitals where all or nearly all intensive care unit beds are occupied. In June, when COVID-19 cases were at their lowest level, less than 1 in 10 hospitals had dangerously high occupancy rates. In Alabama, all intensive care unit beds are currently occupied. In recent days, dozens of patients in the state have needed beds that were not available, according to data published by the Department of Health and Human Services. It means they're in the waiting room. Some are in the back of ambulances. Things are of that nature, said Jeannie Gaines, a spokesperson for the Alabama Hospital Association. In Texas, 169 hospitals have intensive care units that are more than 95% full, up from 69 in June. There are only about 700 intensive care beds remaining across the entire state of Texas, according to recent data. Hospitals in Houston constructed overflow tents last month to handle the influx of patients, and the rate of hospitalizations in the state is now 40% higher than when the tents were first built. Meanwhile, 24 hospitals in Florida have reported having more intensive care unit patients last week than available ICU beds. During past surges, hospitals have been forced to improvise by having staff care for more patients than usual or by setting up temporary intensive care beds in other wings of the hospital. Patients with critical conditions besides COVID, like heart attacks or strokes, can also have worse health outcomes when most beds are full. Unvaccinated Americans are 10 times more likely to be hospitalized with COVID than the vaccinated, according to a recent study by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Several of the states with the highest rates of intensive care unit occupancy, including Alabama and Mississippi, are also among those with the lowest vaccination rates. Our biggest concerns are our low vaccination rate, said Dr. Scott Harris, Alabama's state health officer. Dr. Scott Harris added, "That's the reason we're in the situation that we're in right now. Virtually all of our deaths are people who are unvaccinated. Hospitalizations among children under the age of 18 are also higher than ever during this wave of the coronavirus, driven largely by the surges among children in the least vaccinated states."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The country. confrontation with Iran over its nuclear program.
The United States has announced it's imposing sweeping new sanctions against Iran.
All options are obviously on the table.
I just have to repeat, the president never takes any option off the table.
All options on the table.
Nothing should be ruled out.
We are not going to permit them, if we can prevent it, from becoming a nuclear power.
All options are on the table.
We've got to be prepared to confront them with necessary military.
Iran's nuclear program is one of the most urgent problems facing the world today.
Over the last 7 years, suspicion that Iran is trying to build a nuclear bomb has never been far from the headlines. I've always found it hard to fathom how in 1945, a mere press of a button killed such a huge number of people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
I'd like to see a world free from nuclear weapons, but given the refusal of the world's nuclear states to disarm, I'm not sure they feel the same way. And this makes their targeting of the Iranian nuclear program all the more perplexing.
There's a great deal of international concern because it seems that Iran is on a trajectory to obtain a nuclear weapons capability.
Americans have thousands of nuclear weapons, but we have to feel safe in Iran.
Now, that I do not understand. How is it possible?
There are some pretty big questions that just aren't being asked. What is the story behind Iran's nuclear program? And with this billboard behind me asks the question, today, who does pose the greatest threat to nuclear security? America or Iran? I'm on a journey to understand the history of the Iranian nuclear program. And I'll discover how Western involvement in Iran's past sheds light on its policy towards Iran today.
Nuclear amnesia.
I've been doing some research, reading the diaries of Tony Benn, who was the British Secretary of State for Energy in the 1970s. His diaries say that in 1976 he had a three-hour meeting with the Shah of Iran to talk about the Iranian nuclear program, and that the Americans at the time were in favour of Iran having nuclear power. I asked him whether that was correct.
Yes, it is correct, yes. I wasn't in favour of it myself, because I saw the link between nuclear power and nuclear weapons as being very strong, but still, that was what the American position was. And indeed, more than that, the Americans were in favour of the Shah buying control of our nuclear industry, so we would adopt an American nuclear system, the pressure water reactor, and so they had a commercial as well as a political interest in it, in Iran doing that.
Actually, it was America under President Ford encouraged the Shah of Iran to go for a big build-up of nuclear power stations, 25 of them. And because they thought that if he goes for that program, then American companies, which are very well advanced in building nuclear power plants, they will get a contract.
In 1976, President Gerald Ford signed a directive offering Tehran the chance to buy and operate a US-built reprocessing facility. The idea was that Iran would enrich uranium on its own territory, while US companies stood to gain over $6 billion from selling six nuclear reactors. The plan didn't go through in the end, but nonetheless I found the proposal astonishing. But then I thought, why not? At the time, Iran was an ally to both Britain and the US. The Shah himself had been installed to power in 1953, when a coup, organised by the US and Britain, had removed the elected Prime Minister of the day. The man the Shah chose to head the Iranian nuclear programme in 1974 was Dr. Akbar Etemad.
At the time, they were making a research reactor at the University of Tehran. The work had stopped at the university, and the Shah was very angry. Anyhow, after 2 years' time, we went back forth to the United States and so on. The reactor was finished, and officially, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran was created. And officially, as I became the head of that organization, then I told the Shah that the program has to be very large in order to worth putting money and effort in that. We installed in 1974. In 1980, the first nuclear power plant at Bushehr had to come into operation. Then afterwards, each year we had to have one more unit to come into operation. At the end, we had 4,200 megawatts under construction and 4,800 in negotiation and planning. The Iranian nuclear program was very welcome in France, Germany, partly in England.
I asked Tony whether Britain had connections with the Iranian program at the time.
Well, there was a proposal which wasn't discussed at that meeting, but which I knew about, which was that if Iran did buy our nuclear industry and then sell us nuclear weapons of an American model, then it would please the Americans and please the British government, and I wasn't in favor of it.
Sir Walter Marshall came to see me from England, and I thought we have nothing to do with the British, but I brought him to consider that they can help Iran in the field of nuclear energy. And he became so happy to know that, because he thought that we are going to reject the British. We had very good relationship with England, but England had not the right technology that we selected. In the States, it was also welcome at the beginning.
But you see, what happened was, in 73-74, oil prices quadrupled, and therefore Shah got a lot of money. He became very confident. So when it came to giving contracts, he did not give contracts to Americans. He gave a contract to German company, Siemens.
We signed a letter of intent for the power plant of Bushehr, but I gave them authorization next year to start the work before the contract is there. And we signed an agreement with the French to build a nuclear power plant in Darkhuin with two units of 900 megawatts, and they started the work.
Iran sits above almost 10% of the world's oil, so I asked Dr. Esserman why the Shah made the decision to go nuclear.
He had oil, of course, but the Shah had the idea, and he brought this idea that this raw material should not be used for production of energy. The energy mix is important. We had to have the optimum energy mix in the country, because if one fails, the other one should be there. At that time, in the United States, I remember every year 25,000 megawatts nuclear was ordered. France was achieving a large program of nuclearization of their electricity. Germany, England, and Japan, the same. Most of the countries, they were turning, in fact, into nuclear energy. Then we had to enrich uranium. Enriching uranium, that was a technology that we didn't have. But they had started to build an enrichment plant in France, and they had problems to get money. When Chirac came to Iran, I said, we want to have enrichment, and we want to become a member of it. And little by little, I told him that we have money, we can lend you money also for the construction of the plant. Then the deal was made when he was in Tehran. We gave $1 billion loan to that establishment who were making the plant. And we took 10% of the shares of the plant, and we had to pay for the investment as others.
Esserman signed the agreement. The deal went through, and Iran became a member of Eurodif. And as Iran owned 10% of Eurodif, it had the right to 10% of what the company produced.
In the days of early 70s and so on, late 60s, early 70s, and mid 70s, they were really going all out to produce more and more nuclear power plants, and they needed some money, and apparently Shah gave them some money on the agreement. I'm sure the agreement written down somewhere that you will then supply some of the nuclear products to us in return. But apparently that never happened because of Islamic Revolution, everything as was forgotten.
I realize that Iran looks at this history of having had its deal with Eurodif in France broken for various reasons in the aftermath of the revolution. It wasn't a totally one-sided breaking of the deal by the Europeans. Iran itself chose to back away from nuclear power. But I think it's understandable that Iran does have this sense that because of past difficulties, it needs to be self-sufficient.
After the revolution, when François Mitterrand was elected president of Republic in France, I don't know for what reason, they notified Iran that Iran cannot count on enrichment services of Eurodif, even though if they are a member of that plan.
This is the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's a short document that was signed between loads of nations back in 1968 to try and limit the spread of nuclear weapons throughout the world.
There was very great worry, growing worry at that time, that the number of nuclear weapon states was going to increase very, very rapidly if something wasn't done about it. There were already suspicions about an Israeli nuclear program, about an Indian and a Pakistani program, and gradually international concern mounted, and from that international concern came the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And it's always important to remember that at the time the Non-Proliferation Treaty was negotiated and signed and ratified by pretty well every country in the world except for India, Pakistan and Israel, at that time it was thought that there could be anything between 25 and 35 nuclear weapon states by the end of the century. And so the success of the non-proliferation regime can be measured against those concerns that were expressed at that time.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty is made up of a preamble and 11 articles. The treaty is often interpreted as a three-pillar system. Here's Etemad going through them.
One is that those countries who do not have nuclear weapons, they should not go for it. That is the commitment of the non-nuclear countries. The second pillar of the NPT is that those countries who have the nuclear technology, they have committed themselves to transfer it to the countries that they need it. And the third pillar is that those countries who have nuclear weapons, they have committed themselves to reach a conclusion for a general nuclear disarmament in the world.
The whole clause that all the recognized nuclear powers, of which the five of them, which are also members of the Security Council, permanent member Security Council, they will start disarming the nuclear thing. Not a single step has been taken in that direction.
The failure of the nuclear weapon states to live up to their commitments made under the Non-Proliferation Treaty itself undermines the treaty and thereby undermines international law.
India developed nuclear weapons in the 1970s and conducted its first nuclear test explosion in 1974. And in 1998, after crucial aid from the Reagan administration, Pakistan detonated its first nuclear weapon.
India, Pakistan, Israel, they are not members of NPT. From the beginning, they didn't want to become members of NPT because they had intentions and they have made the nuclear weapon. But they are respected, they are countries that nobody goes against them, nobody suspects them, and so on. It is amazing.
The perception of double standards is a problem. Israel is assumed to have between 100 and 200 nuclear weapons, is not under pressure by the United States to join the NPT.
The West has helped Israel to get the bomb. I know the details of what France has even to Israel. The U.S. was informed all the time, they knew it, and they gave the nuclear weapon to Israel, and Israel is making a nuclear weapon, and they have an arsenal.
I discovered that one of my officials, who was actually in charge of non-proliferation, was secretly supplying nuclear material to Israel. And of course, Israel has always denied that it has nuclear weapons. Everybody knows it does have. It's the fourth most powerful nuclear weapon state in the world. And the incredible thing is that you hear Israeli ministers now saying you cannot have a nuclear power in the Middle East, you can't have Iran, when they themselves are one, and they haven't even signed the non-proliferation treaty.
Israel has an arsenal of at least 200 warheads and plenty of ways to deliver them, and everybody knows where its nuclear reactor is in the Negev Desert, but they are never, because they've adopted this, I would call it a ploy of saying we won't admit it, we don't talk about whether we've got one or not got one.
Israel has never acknowledged having nuclear weapons, and it maintains a policy known as nuclear ambiguity.
Israel has not threatened any other countries with its assumed nuclear arsenal, and it hasn't agreed to, it hasn't taken on any international commitments like Iran did.
The fact that they have introduced nuclear weapons unilaterally into the Middle East and have managed to avoid any clear censure by the international community, and particularly by Britain and the United States, is clearly evidence of double standards.
This is called selectivity. You select certain things and go for them. And they are not logical. You're not saying, okay, all those which are not signing NTP, they are bad guys, they're rogue states. We won't trade with them, sanctions against them.
India, Pakistan, and Israel never signed the NPT, and it's sometimes implied that because they didn't sign the document, it's okay for them to develop nuclear weapons.
The United States and France and Russia, they are trying to get into cooperation with India to give them technology, to give them everything, because they have not signed the NPT and they are outside the NPT. They can do whatever they want. They make bombs.
It should be a an issue that pertains to everyone. It's important not to be discriminating against any country. But the focus of concern is on Iran, because Iran did violate its safeguards agreement with the IAEA.
There has been a focus, too much I would say, on particular countries. Just as today we have too great a focus on Iran and its nuclear activities in isolation to other countries. It would be a mistake simply to then shift that focus exclusively on Israel. We have to focus on Israel, on Iran, on Britain, on America, on Russia, on China, and develop a universal arrangement whereby all countries have to live up to their commitments.
But it's not clear that the nuclear states are living up to their commitments. In 2008, the US struck a sharp blow to the Non-Proliferation Treaty by signing a nuclear agreement with India, which effectively authorizes India to produce its own nuclear weapons. And far from decommissioning its nuclear submarines, the British government wants to replace its nuclear missile system with an upgrade.
The signatories to the treaty are setting a very bad example by doing the opposite of what the treaty asks them to do. For example, in this country, we have a program of renewal in Trident weaponry. That isn't the same as showing to the rest of the world and those countries that we wish to focus upon that we are doing our best to reduce the chances of nuclear weapons being used in war or in anger.
There is this sense within this country that the debate over both nuclear power and nuclear weapons can be isolated from the rest of the world. It's fine for us to have nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, but it is not fine for other countries to have it. It's too dangerous for other countries, but for us, we're happy.
I'm reading UN Security Council Resolution 687. It's the document the US and Britain appealed to when they were trying to find a legal cover for the first Persian Gulf War, because it calls on Iraq to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction. But Article 14 of the same resolution commits Britain and the US to establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone released. It struck me that if that was implemented, Western nations would show they were serious about ridding the Middle East of nuclear weapons.
As far as I see, for at least for two centuries, there is no record of Iran attacking any other country. But we have been attacked so many times. We have been invaded so many times. And the last one, by Saddam Hussein of Iraq, with the help of the West, they gave him everything.
Indeed, Iran is the only NPT signatory in the world. The only one. They cannot convince the IAEA that its nuclear program is intended for peaceful purposes.
If you see you have something in hand, prove it. Iran, they ask Iran to prove that Iran is not going for nuclear weapons. This is against the principle of law in the West. In the West, you have not to prove that you are innocent. Somebody else has to prove that you have done something wrong. Not everybody, every day, you have to go out and prove you are innocent. You are innocent as far as you are innocent.
And there are concerns that the terms of the debate that the US uses when talking about the Iranian nuclear program could be counterproductive.
By approaching it in this way and talking about restricting Iran's abilities and technologies when Iran has a right to those technologies, frames the whole debate in terms of rights, which I think undermines a proper comprehensive debate within Iran around what is in Iran's interests rather than its rights. So we have a situation where there's pretty much universal agreement within Iran, as far as we can tell, behind a nuclear power program, primarily because it is being told by other countries, you can't have what we've got.
The Iranian government can very clearly clarify for the world in saying that we are not getting anything out of NPT and we are suffering from NPT. And if this is going on, maybe we decide to come out of NPT because we are not really going to stay in some kind of organization which doesn't bring us anything at all.
Just before I wrapped up my interview with Tony, he told me to look to the past if I wanted to understand the present.
It shows how important history is. If you don't follow the history, you don't understand the arguments. When the Shah was there, and he was a plant in Iran, when the Shah was there, then everything that Iran did was okay with America. When the Shah was replaced by the revolution, then of course it was completely different.
The only way that can be justified is by moving away from this idea that the world is ruled by the rule of law and to see it as a situation of alliances and relationships.
The problem of Iran with the West is not nuclear energy, according to me, but they use nuclear energy as a leverage to put political pressure on them.
The US and Britain do care about nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, but only when it suits them. Their involvement in the history of the Iranian nuclear program shows that much. And a lot of the policies these nuclear states are pushing actually encourage the spread of nuclear weapons around the world. And it seems clear enough that the focus on Iran is being used as a tool to put political pressure on a country they don't control.
The close ties between incarceration and pollution seen in Detroit are replicated across the United States. A recent Grist analysis found that the nation's three largest jail systems, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, have facilities disproportionately located in areas where there are elevated risks for pollution-related cancer, respiratory hazards, diesel pollution exposure, and proximity to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste.
In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Adam Mahoney, writer. This article is published under the heading, Detroit's prison population will soon be stuck living next to a toxic site. Stay tuned for more. For 3 decades, Detroit Renewable Power had burned 3,000 tons of trash every day, emitting dangerous levels of nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and lead into the atmosphere, contaminating surrounding neighborhoods. RA had spent years fighting to close the toxic site. Between 2013 and 2018, the incinerator racked up more than 750 citations for exceeding pollution emissions standards from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or MDEQ. And according to a local environmental law center, the incinerator violated the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Air Act over 100 times as well. Data from the EPA and MDEQ shows that the facility is located in one of Wayne County's worst neighborhoods for air pollution, a community that is also 76% people of color and 71% of low income. After being released, Ra and her colleagues succeeded in getting the incinerator shut down in 2019. The closure doesn't completely eliminate the environmental threat, however. Studies have shown that contaminants emitted during waste incineration have the ability to infiltrate surrounding soil and groundwater, but impacts that persist for years even after a site is closed. Now, Detroit officials say a new jail complex is needed to address safety concerns in the city's aging jails, as well as save on maintenance costs. But the city's plan to construct the Wayne County Criminal Justice Center across the street from the old Detroit Renewable Power Incinerator will force up to 2,400 incarcerated people to live in close proximity to the facility's toxic legacy. While trash is no longer being burned on site, Detroit Renewable Power is still operating as a solid waste transfer station, taking in 1,000 tons of waste per day. Transfer waste stations are known to emit odors, cause noise, attract rodents, and cause air emissions both from unloading dry and dusty waste and increased traffic in the immediate neighborhood. Down the street from the new jail site, just beyond the recently shuttered incinerator, is a hazardous waste treatment plant known to fill the air with a rotting fish smell, which over the past 6 years has itself received more than 20 pollution violations from MDEQ, now called the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. The waste treatment plant's violations are primarily for pungent odors released into the neighborhood, but also for dust and soot emissions beyond the state limits. Local residents say the emissions often make simply being outside unbearable. The jail site is also right next to I-75, a major highway, adding another source of noise and air pollution that inmates will be exposed to. Living in Detroit has given me a deep understanding that fights against the prison system and police are also fights against poverty and pollution, Ra told GIST. The close ties between incarceration and pollution seen in Detroit are replicated across the United States. A recent GIST analysis found that the nation's three largest jail systems, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, have facilities disproportionately located in areas where there are elevated risks for pollution-related cancer, respiratory hazards, diesel pollution exposure, and proximity to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste. According to the EPA, those incarcerated within the new Wayne County Criminal Justice Center will be exposed to more diesel pollution and situated closer to hazardous waste than 90% of the country. The jail's location on Detroit's east side within a heavily polluted area wasn't in the original plans. The project, which first got underway in 2011, was initially slated to be built in downtown Detroit, close to public transit. But after the city ran over budget on the jail, construction paused. Officials made a deal with Dan Gilbert, co-founder of Quicken Loans, a company accused of fraudulent lending, and founder of Bedrock, a real estate business, both of which fall under Gilbert's parent company, Rock Venture, which includes over 100